Shopify is leveling the playing field for entrepreneurs with software that helps anyone with a great idea build a successful business. More than 50% of the business owners they power are women across 175 countries, and they're growing their world-class team to define the future of entrepreneurship. Visit shopify.com/careers to find out how they work.
And welcome to Know You Go, the show about being ambitious and sticking together. I'm Jen Lucas.
I'm Cattell Ledoux.
And I'm Sarah Wachter-Betcher. Today on Know You Go, we're talking with one of my favorite authors, Carmen Maria Machado, whose first book of stories, Her Body and Other Parties, was just listed as one of 15 remarkable books by women that are shaping the way we read and write fiction in the 21st century by the New York Times. Like, seriously. Carmen's also a writer in residence at the University of Pennsylvania, which means she lives right here in Philly. And that got me thinking a lot about place. You know, like in a lot of industries, we sort of expect people who are ambitious to live in a specific location. Like, you're a writer, gotta move to New York. Oh, you're in tech? Well, why aren't you in San Francisco? But like, Philly is great. There's so much amazing stuff happening here. And I wish more people knew that.
Oh, I love Philadelphia. You should see the Philadelphia tattoo I have across my abs. Just kidding.
I was like, what? Show me.
Oh my God.
But I do in spirit. In spirit, it's there. Just Ben Franklin hanging out, eating a pretzel right on my bicep.
You know, love it. Very on brand.
Can we all get like matching Ben Franklin eating a pretzel tattoos?
Or just like a Liberty Bell, something small, tasteful.
What do you love so much about Philly, Jen?
Oh, I've been in Philadelphia for, 18 years?
Wow.
Whoa. How did that happen?
Like your whole adult life.
Yeah, pretty much. And at first I didn't love Philadelphia. I came here from Boston and I was just like, why? What am I doing still in the cold? I guess is what I was thinking. And I don't know. I felt like there's just something that wasn't great. And then within like 2 years, it just grew on me. I love that it's flat, it's cheap, and it's got a lot of great people and so much good food. But it's got that, Philadelphia has this interesting thing in that it has like, people will say like this inferiority complex of a city where, you know, we're between DC, New York, Boston, and always something to prove. I feel like there's a lot of that, which I think has led to a lot of great innovation. A lot of people just like building lots of stuff to be like, no, look at all this amazing things that we have here. I had the chance once to work for visitphilly.com website, which was probably one of the best projects I ever worked on because it was just having a chance every day to come in and work on something that showcased our fine city. And I think it's so important to have pride in where you live because it's where you spend your time.
I feel like I lived in New York for 5 years of my life, like my late 20s, and I loved it. It was great. And coming from DC, it was sort of like, I got the sense that people were kind of like, oh, you finally moved to like a real city, which totally felt like not at all. And then when I got back to DC after living in New York, people were kind of like, why would you ever leave New York? And there are, you know, personally, a million reasons why I left New York. I feel like it's odd to get that reaction depending on where you live. And when I was in DC for that second time, I was working at National Geographic. So when I told people where I worked, they were like, oh, that's amazing. And I'm like, yeah, that's where HQ is. It's in DC. Like,
I think one of the things that's so frustrating to me about talking about place is that kind of reaction that you're talking about, though. Like, oh, you live there? I remember this one time I was having brunch with a friend of a friend in New York. We were in Brooklyn and this woman, I didn't know her very well. She asked me where I lived and I said I lived in Philly. And she goes, oh, Philly? Well, it's a good starter city for New York. And I looked at her and I was just like, I just like dead eyed her. And I was like, or it's just a place that people live by choice. It was just like one of those throwaway comments for her, because in her head, her assumption was like basically everybody was just trying to move to New York and like you would only live somewhere else if you like couldn't make it in New York or whatever. And I'm like, I don't want to live in New York. I like New York. It's fine. But what I think is important to remember, and I think about this a lot for the podcast, is like there are people doing awesome shit literally everywhere. And one of the things that we can do is do a better job of seeking that out, you know, finding folks in all kinds of places. Like way back, I think in our second episode, we talked to Eileen Webb, who lives in Northern New Hampshire and is doing all of this awesome work on accessibility and strategy on the web. And like, she lives on a farm. I'm like, why not? Why the hell not? Why can't we look at people doing great stuff everywhere? So that brings me back to something that I loved about talking with Carmen, who is doing this amazing work as an author and becoming like straight up a famous writer. And she's right here in Philly. And I suspect in like all kinds of cities out there, you would find people who are just like top of their game in their fields, working from all kinds of unexpected places.
And not just cities. I mean, more rural areas, towns. I think one of the things that we always have to keep in mind that we do here is that there's things about Philly that I love, obviously, and there's things about Philly that I don't like. And that's true of any place. And so I think the trick is finding that balance of someplace that you really like to be that helps you be the best you.
Thinking about the idea of a starter city assumes that, you know, everyone has the same resources or lifestyle that would allow you to just like move wherever you want to go and move to, you know, a really potentially expensive city or a place that, you know, you might just not have the resources that kind of work in that area that you can really have access to. So I don't know. I want to pay more attention to, like Sarah said, you know, the work that people are doing that aren't on the coasts or aren't, you know, in the places that we know our networks and all of our friends are. I think it's kind of cool that we start looking at that.
Well, with that, can we go ahead and get to the interview? Because I'm super hyped to have everybody listen to this interview with Carmen.
Ugh, can't wait.
We want to be able to share our voices our way through our website, and we use WordPress to help us do that because it gives us freedom and flexibility. Make your site your own when you build it with WordPress. They offer powerful e-commerce options from a simple yet effective buy button to a complete online store. And WordPress customer support is there for you 24/7 to help you get your site working smoothly. Plans start at just $4 per month, so start building your website today. Go to wordpress.com/knowyougo for 15% off any new plan purchase. That's wordpress.com/knowyougo for 15% off your brand new website.
Over a year ago, I read this amazing essay in Guernica called "The Trash Heap Has Spoken" about women who refuse to apologize for taking up space. Fat women with fat minds, as the author, Carmen Maria Machado, put it. It was a gorgeous essay, and it's one that I actually still think about all the time. So when her book came out last year, I devoured it immediately. Fast forward just a few months, and Her Body and Other Parties, a book of stories that defy genre, that are fantastical and erotic and queer and just were really captivating to me, has been awarded about a zillion prizes. It's been a bestseller. It was a finalist for the National Book Award. And somehow, despite all of that huge success, we still managed to get Carmen Maria Machado here to be interviewed on Know You Go. And literally, she's here today. She is in our studio, also known as my office in South Philadelphia. And I'm extremely excited to chat with her and also a little bit nervous. Carmen, welcome to Know You Go.
Thank you for having me.
So first up, okay, after I read that essay in Guernica, I found out that you went to college with a friend of the show, Laura Hogan, and she said that you did photography together. So first up, like, when did you start pursuing writing as a career and sort of what was that path for you?
Yeah, well, I've been a writer or a person who writes or sort of organizes her mind around writing for my entire life. I've been that way since I was a kid. And when I got to college, I wanted to be a journalist. That was sort of my way. I was like, oh, I'll like have health insurance and also, you know, have a job and like be a writer. And of course this was like 2004. I got to school, I started journalism classes and I did not like them. I was like, this is not me. I do not have a nose for news. I don't like hunting down news stories. I don't like talking to people on the phone. Like all of these things that would be required of me as a journalist are things that just bore me or make me too anxious, and I don't want to do it, even though I like writing. So I sort of moved around. I switched majors a few times. I was like lit for a hot second, and then I switched to something else. And then finally, I took a photography class, and I absolutely loved it. And so I ended up getting like an independent study major where I sort of combined a lot of things, including writing and photography and fine arts, where I met Laura. So then like I had this idea of like being a photographer that did not last very long. But I've never supported myself doing it. I've worked all kinds of jobs. It's just never been a thing that really like worked out for me. So I have a really nice Instagram account. That's like the way that my student loans that I'm still paying off, that's what they're still going towards, is really well curated Instagram account. And that's about it. And then, you know, after school, I was living in California, just sort of working some random jobs. And it wasn't until I went to grad school, which would have been in 2010, that I really started thinking about writing as a career and as a thing I could pursue sort of more professionally.
And you were in grad school in Iowa, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What was that experience like? Because it's a pretty intense program, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's the oldest program in the country, which is sort of where it gets its reputation from. You know, there's a lot of really wonderful writers who've gone there. I had a really good time. It was really nice to be able to go to a program that was funded, that I was able to just like write and like not have to worry about work and not have to worry about anything else. Like I did do a little bit of teaching, which also was nice because then I discovered that I really liked teaching, which before I did not realize.
Speaking of teaching, mm-hmm. I saw that after grad school, you had ended up kind of back in the Philly area, adjuncting, mm-hmm. While also working at the mall. And I'm curious, like, when do you feel like it all started to come together for you career-wise?
That's a really good question. I mean, it sort of happens in stages. So while I was in grad school, through a friend, I met my now wife, and we were dating long distance and decided after I was finished that we wanted to move in together wherever we landed. So she was living in Boston at the time. I was living in Iowa City, and we decided to come to Philadelphia because it was like an affordable city we could live in. And she had lived here before. I had never had, but I grew up in Allentown, so not too far away. So yeah, so we got here, and in the beginning, I mean, I was really struggling. Like, she was working a full-time job and was more or less supporting us. I was, you know, adjuncting and working a retail job and making like barely anything. Like, I was really struggling. Yeah, I was going to King of Prussia Mall. I was driving back and forth every week, and it was horrible. And I was very stressed out and sad, and was, you know, sort of plugging away at some work and was just writing some stories. And I don't know, feeling like maybe I had made a mistake, or maybe like writing just wasn't in the cards for me professionally. And it was really hard to write because I was physically exhausted all the time just from standing. Like, teaching, you know, it is exhausting in its own way, but like with working at the mall, like, I was just like on my feet all day. I was driving really far back and forth, and I was exhausted. So at some point I applied for a writing residency at the Malay Colony for the Arts, which is up in upstate New York. And I got in for a session. So I quit my job, went there for a month, and like wrote a bunch of stuff. And that actually got me back in this really nice headspace where I suddenly found myself like able to be like, I have a whole book here and I need to just kind of get it all pulled together. And so I had written this story called The Husband Stitch, which is probably my most famous short story. Someone once called it my hit single. Like, it is kind of like my hit single. It's like the story people usually know of mine. And so, yeah, and I had an agent at this point, and I sent it to him, and he submitted it to magazines, and Granta ended up picking it up and putting it on their website. And so that was sort of like the turning point for me, because that story did really well. People really responded to it. Because it was online, people were able to share it, and there was just like a lot of sort of movement around that story. And in fact, I believe last year they told me it was still their most read story at their website. Even though it's 3 years old, like, it's been out for 3 years, but like they were like, oh yeah, no, like there's just been a ton of traffic to that story. It's like a really highly trafficked page on the site. So that was sort of the moment. Like, once I had that, and then I started putting together this collection, and then in about a year, so that would have been 2014. So then I sold the book in 2015, like in the fall. So yeah, and then once that happened, and then I got like this offer at Penn, where I'm now the writer in residence. So I suddenly had a teaching job where I had like health insurance and like a living salary and like all these other things. And that was pretty awesome. So that's, it just ended up sort of working out nicely, where that became like the place where my career sort of turned and people started to pay attention and sort of knew who I was, and everything has sort of followed from there.
And I think for listeners who don't know about the adjunct teaching market, it's a, I don't know, exploitative nightmare, I would say. So like, if you're curious at the differences between adjuncting and having a fellowship at Penn where you have benefits, it's like night and day. Yeah. A lot of adjuncts are very contingent faculty, and it's like a couple thousand dollars a semester to teach courses, and you end up making, I don't know, probably less than minimum wage in a lot of places.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You're making less. Because like you're usually like have office hours and all the grading, everything you're doing outside of class and prepping for class. Yeah, no, it's actually really bad. And it's funny because I think sometimes students, I'll ask occasionally, like, see if students have a sense of what adjuncts, like who they are or what their situation is. And even now they really don't. And I, you know, when I was in college, I also did not understand what adjuncts were. Like I had adjuncts and I like didn't realize it because like to a student, it's like, oh, you're my teacher. Like, what's the difference? But it's like, oh, the difference is huge. Like adjuncts are, you know, often like broke as hell. Like they're getting food stamps and they can like barely make ends meet. So yeah, it's like a really, it's one of those, you know, it's a labor issue that's like getting a lot of traction. And like in Philadelphia, they're actually like there's an adjunct union that's been unionizing various schools, and they've been actually pretty successful, which is pretty awesome. But yeah, it's a bad situation for sure.
And I'm curious, like you mentioned that you really loved teaching, and was it difficult to balance out this feeling of like loving teaching, but knowing that you're doing it in this like kind of exploitative environment and where you can't actually make a living off of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the hardest thing for me was that I couldn't be there for my students in the way I wanted to be, because it was just unpaid labor. So like, you know, like I would grade and I would do workshop and I would prep lectures and I'd do all this stuff. But then like if a student wanted like more feedback on something, like I wasn't getting paid for that, you know, and so I have to say no to things, and the students didn't understand. And some would be like, well, why can't you do that thing for me? Like, you're my teacher. And I was like, well, in normal circumstances, yes, certainly, like, you know, yes, as a teacher, like, for example, if a student comes to you for like a letter of recommendation or something, like that's part of the process, right, of being a teacher, is being like, yes, like I am at least open to the idea of writing you a letter of recommendation, for example, or like talking to you, you know, within the semester about certain things. But when you're an adjunct, like all bets are off, because you're not making any, you're making, yeah, $3,000 a class, right? So it's like, what are you supposed to do? Like, how are you supposed to like value and manage your time? That part is really, really hard. And when students don't understand it, and you can't just say like, oh, by the way, like I'm an adjunct, like your school does not care enough to like pay me a living wage, and you need to take that up with them. There's nothing to do with me, you know? So I think it's a combination of like, just because students don't know. And then just like trying to decide like, where do you value your time? You know, if you're a good teacher, like you want to be there for your students, like you want to be able to help them during the semester in the way that you can. But yeah, like when you're not making any money, you're like, this is just, I'm just giving them free time. Like I'm not, you know, I'm not doing it. So yeah, it's a really bad situation.
Well, so your situation has changed pretty dramatically since then. And I would like to talk about that. So in addition to being a National Book Award finalist, which I like to say over and over again, because I think it's fucking awesome. You were just called part of the new Vanguard by the New York Times. Mm-hmm. What's that like?
that was shocking. Nothing that's happened to me I've expected any of it. Like, if you told me, like, oh, your weird, like, genre-bending short story collection that's, like, gonna be out from us independent press is gonna, like, do just crazily well in every respect, I would have never, ever, ever in a million years, I've been like, you're crazy, that's ridiculous, there's no way. But yeah, everything that's been happening, and then, yeah, that New York Times piece where they were sort of talking about, like, women writers of the 21st century who have, like, who are sort of showing us how we read and write. Like, and that my book being one of those 15 books is just completely unbelievable.
So, I mean, when that happens, I assume you also have a lot of sudden like demands on your time and attention. Mm-hmm. How do you negotiate that? Like, how do you figure out what you're going to say yes to?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, you have to, like, I'm learning to be more protective of my time. The thing is that's weird in the beginning was that, you know, I wasn't sure how the book was going to do. And so I said yes to everything. And then at some point, you have to kind of decide, like, I'm not going to do this or I'm not going to do this. And I was lucky that my wife is actually she's brilliant and very, very good at knowing all my weak spots. So, for example, this spring, she made me build in free weekends where, like, I was not allowed to schedule anything. And it's just weekends that I have off. And at the time, I was like very grouchy about that. I was like, oh, I don't want to do that. But I'm so grateful that she did that, because now there are like our weekends where I'm like, I don't have to do anything. I can just relax. I can do laundry. Yeah. Right. I can just like do what I have to do.
You can have a weekend.
I can have a weekend.
That's called a weekend.
Right. Yeah. It's called a weekend. Right. Where I'm not traveling. But I've been traveling except for those weekends. I've traveled every single weekend for the last like 6 months. Like I've just been, you know, so it's hard. And I think it's also like remembering, right, like it's okay that right now I'm doing that, but then like knowing that this summer I'm going to a residency, I'm going to go back to working because like I haven't been writing and that's making me really sad. So like knowing that I had that on the horizon, you know, saying no to things, like saying, you know, and like I sort of have a set of criteria. So if I get asked to do something, it's like, you know, do I know the person who's asking me? Is it something that I really want to do? Like I'm like, oh, I want to be with that publication, or I want to, you know, there's like a reason. Sometimes something is just, it's fun where it's like, oh, that sounds really cool. Yeah, I do want to try that. So right now I'm judging this cookbook contest for Food 52 and they like asked me to do it. And I was like, that's so weird. Yes, I do want to do that. Cause like, yeah. I love cooking and like, they're like, we'll send you these cookbooks. You'll cook from them. And like there's like a tournament. It's like a tournament of cookbooks or whatever. And I was like, yeah, I do want to do that. That's like so weird. So like, I'll say yes to that sort of thing. So it just becomes a matter of like figuring out what my priorities are. Like, you know, so I sort of run every opportunity through like a little set of filters where I'm like, does it have this? Does it have this? Does this? And I'll say yes or no.
Yes. I've had those periods. I mean, I travel a lot for work things and conferences and book things. And it's like, I'm mostly pretty good at it. Mm-hmm. And then I realize that I'm like, oh no, I have limits. And like, I need to remember them. I used to do things like book those like multi-stop trips, like three stops. Yeah. And then I realized like I'm fucking miserable every time I do it. And I was like, what if you just didn't do that anymore? Right, like, what if you just said no to things that would require that? Yeah. And I found that was like, when you talk about finding like criteria and stuff, it's like, oh, notice those patterns. Like, what are the patterns that are making you unhappy and getting rid of them?
Yeah, or like I had someone once tell me, like, you should never do anything where the amount of money you're being paid to do it, you're not excited to go. So like, if you are like, if you're like, I don't want to get on a plane, go to this place, do all this work, go on a plane back, lose a weekend, and it's for like $500 or whatever. Yeah. Like, you know, like learning like what is it that you actually want? What is worth it to you to like get out of the house or like, and like leave your loved ones and like get on a fucking airplane, which is like just fucking hell.
I mean, I also feel like, I definitely will say yes to things sometimes. I don't do this a lot anymore, but I used to have this problem where I would say yes to something. And like, as I was writing the email saying yes, I had that like tight knot in my stomach.
Yeah, you're like, I don't want to do this.
I knew deep down I didn't actually want to say yes. And so now I'm trying to be way more aware and like also let those emails sit a little longer.
Yes. Yeah. But this is also a thing I've noticed is if I don't answer it right away. And also like I sort of went through this phase where I felt a little guilty about this, but I said yes to some things and then I actually thought about it and then I wrote them back and I was like, you know, I'm so sorry. Like I know I agreed to do this yesterday, but I've just been thinking about it more and I think I actually don't have the time. And I did that earlier this year. And I almost like cried from relief. And the person who was super nice about it, they're like, don't even worry about it. Like, you're obviously so busy. It's totally fine. And then I was like, so happy. I was like, oh, free. Like I could have been stressing about this for 2 weeks and said, I just like said, nope, actually I can't do it. Sorry.
And that feeling of relief is such a huge sign.
Right.
And it's not like you're waiting until the day before this thing is going on. Exactly. It's like you are, you know, you're paying attention to it and you're like, okay, I need to just remove this from my plate and my future for, you know, whatever reasons. And that's okay.
Yeah.
There's also like just the incredible unmatched joy of canceling plans. So good. But yeah, so I read a book review the other day of yours for Danielle Lazarin's Back Talk. Mm-hmm. And I would love to talk about it a little bit because in there, you know, you talk about how it explores the exhausting, slow poison of masculine power, the grind of the patriarchy and even the most privileged of women. And you pose kind of a question in there, like, how do writers divest themselves from the pressures of the dominant culture while also addressing the burdensome weight of that dominant culture? And I think that piece and your Guernica essay last year, all of those things are sort of like attempting to wrangle with internalized misogyny at some level. And that's something I feel like is sort of cropping up a good bit among feminist writers. So I'm wondering if you can talk more about that. Like, I feel like in that article, you started to answer that question a little bit of like, how do we divest ourselves of that internalized misogyny? Is like, don't be pleasant or easy to teach. Look mean for the camera. Just get up and go. Mm-hmm. What does that look like? Like, how do you get up and go?
Oh, that's a really huge question. I mean, I think this is the, it's so funny. I feel like there's this, right, this idea that like you become more conservative as you get older. And I think that's a really weird idea because I feel like every woman I know gets more and more radical the older they get, because it's like the world, the bullshit of being a woman in today's culture or in any culture or any time or whatever is so awful that like just the longer you're alive, the more radical you become. So I feel like I'm way more radical in terms of like my thoughts about gender than I was like 10 years ago, which is amazing to me. And I think is sort of the opposite of what most people would expect. But yeah, so I mean, I think, yeah, I do think right now this topic of internalized misogyny, and like I talk about in that essay, like Claire V. Watkins' essay on pandering. And I also talk about Cat Person, that story in The New Yorker, all of which also deal with this concept of like internalized misogyny. So like, I think what's really interesting is that right now, I have a lot of thoughts about like Hillary Clinton. Like I feel like there's like a lot of what's in the air right now is like post this election, and like regardless of how you feel about Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton specifically, I think we can all agree that like the way that misogyny played out on this really massive scale during the election was like really traumatic for women. And I think we actually have not fully addressed that trauma. And I think we just went into pure panic mode because like Trump was president and suddenly like, you know, skitter right past it. But like, I think there's something about when people talk about like women, like white women voting for Trump. And I think that is interesting, not just because obviously like it's this way in which like race alliances, racism, sort of Trump, no pun intended, this like gender element, and the way in which women loathe themselves so deeply on this like deep sort of cultural level, right? That like, even though Hillary Clinton is like the most privileged woman probably to ever to walk the fucking planet, that she couldn't win that election against this like incompetent, blowhard, like caricature of a sexist guy from like an 80s cartoon. Like that to me is just an illustration of like how broken it is. Again, regardless of how you think about her specifically. And I think that like Cat Person's another really good example of that in terms of that story, like where it's all about like, it's like, again, not about rape exactly, but it's about like, what does it mean that like women, it's like easier to have sex with a man that you're not really that into than to like say no and walk away? Because it is. And like, I have been there. I have personally been there. It's absolutely. Like, I don't want to do this. And most women I know have been there where they're like, I really don't want to do this, but I'd rather like just not have to deal with like not saying no. And literally the Stormy Daniels interview, you guys watched it, but like,
I specifically did not watch it. I read about it later, but yeah, that's kind of the story too, right? It's like, she's like, well, I might as well do this.
He's like, were you attracted to him? And she was like, oh no. She's like, and then she was like, and then he was like, well, why'd you do it? She's like, well, I thought to myself, like, here I am. Like, I'm stupid enough to get into his room. Like, I might as well just like do this. And it's like this same like absolute like resolve, where it's like the resolve, it's like I can't fight this anymore, like it just is what it is. It's easier to have sex with this totally odious man, right, than it is to like just get out of here because he could do God knows what. And so I feel like there's something about that that's really interesting. And I feel like the Claire V. Watkins essay, again, dealing with this idea of like women trying to align themselves with men, which I think is also like a massive problem that we don't really talk about a lot. And I feel like this narrative of sort of like, you know, women being like, I'm just one of the guys. And like, I knew a woman like that in college. There was this woman who like, that was literally like, she was just like, I'm just one of the dudes. Like, I don't, you know. And it always struck me as like deeply, profoundly sad. And I feel like it, the more I sort of live, like the more I'm like, God, that's the saddest, worst thing. This idea that like femininity and femaleness is so odious to somebody that they would just be like, I reject that. Women are, she's like, oh yeah, women are just drama queens. I'd rather like align myself with men. And even queer women aligning themselves with like male power. So like women who even aren't attracted to men necessarily being like, oh, I need to like align myself in that way. And so that to me is really interesting. And I think that there's something in there that we're coming to this, like, I don't know if it'll actually be a catharsis, but I feel like we're sort of, this is like what's in the air right now. And I feel like we're arriving in this place where we're having to reckon with like, again, like not just this like cartoonish, like male villainy. That's so, I mean, the problem is that like Trump is like cartoonish male villainy, but what's actually way worse is like, again, this slow, almost invisible grind. And the ways in which women then within themselves reinforce that, even when they sort of, the power is not directly on them in that moment. And I feel like that is something that we like need to figure out. And I don't know if we will. I don't know if that's possible, but it's something that is very interesting to me as a writer. And so it's like what I write about. And so of course that book, that, you know, writing that review gave me a little space to like talk about that, because it was, I was like, oh, this is exactly what this book is about. So like, here I'm able to like talk about this idea that I have.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this comes up in all kinds of fields. I mean, I definitely know early in my career, I
spend a lot of time hanging out with the dudes in my office because the dudes in my office were like in positions of more power oftentimes. And they were fun. They were nice. I mean, they were in lots of ways great people, but that I definitely had a couple of years in there where it was almost like I set aside a lot of the more like overt feminist work that I'd done prior to that and was like, I'm here to, you know, get shit done and move up and make space for myself. And I'll do that by fitting in for a round of beers with these dudes. And I couldn't really see it that way at the time. Like I could not have explained that that was what I was doing, but looking back, it's like, that was definitely what I was doing. And there came this moment where I was just like, I don't fucking want to. And what I realized is that over the past several years, I mean, definitely since the election, but even before that, I was going through a process of sort of like reevaluating the men in my life. Mm-hmm. Like I have a husband, I love him. He's great. He's still in my life. He stayed. But like, I definitely cut out a lot of people who I thought I was like supposed to like, yeah, or people who were important in my field or whatever. Right. Like, yeah. I was just like, oh, is this actually bringing me anything in my life?
And I do think that's also, I think that's, it's part of getting older. I do feel like as you get older, you're like, well, life is short. I will die one day. I can't like waste time on people who are like making me miserable or like don't, mm-hmm, or don't, you know, they don't, not that you like, and not in like a self-serving way, we're like only people who can help, but like just being like, no, like that person doesn't give me any joy. That person like makes me feel bad about myself, you know, whoever, like I want to, but then yeah, there's this element also of like, like my tolerance for like male masculine bullshit is like this big. People who are listening, you can't see. I'm making a very tiny little notch with my fingers. It's like almost nothing. Cause like, I'm just like, I don't have time for your weird shit. Like, I don't want to deal with that. I got to live my life. I got to make art. I got a life. Like, but I crave the company of other women. And I mean, I'm queer, but also like, I just crave, like, I think women are more interesting. I think women are just more interesting, and I feel like they, yeah, it's like I don't have to explain myself to, yes, women. I don't have to explain. We just know.
Yeah, you don't have to explain about being or existing in small facets of ways that like seem like they should be obvious, but
yeah, right. Like when you're like, well, you know, sometimes you just had sex with somebody because it was easier than leaving, and everybody's like, oh yeah, yeah, I get it.
Everyone knows what you're talking about. They're like, yes, no man. Almost, well, I'm sure some men, but almost, sure. But in terms of probably a very tiny percentage, but every woman knows what that's like. Every single woman. It's like, oh yeah, where you're like, I don't know this guy. I don't know what he'll do if I say no. Or the having to deal with like the whining and the inevitable like bullshit's going to come with me saying no. It's just like easier for me just to like have sex and then like go away. So like that, right. It's like, well, women know that. And I think that's, it's really nice to have that. And I think what's really nice about what's happening sort of in terms of art and writing right now is like you are getting a lot of these narratives are sort of being presented, like well before like Cat Person and like all these other stuff that's been the last couple of years. There was this really amazing piece, I want to say in BuzzFeed, maybe like 2 or 3 years ago, that was also about this idea where it's like not rape, but it's like, what about this exact phenomenon where it's like, it's not rape, it's not sexual assault, like you consent technically, but you're consenting because of this like larger power structure that like is totally out of your control, and like all things being equal you would say no, but like you just don't want to deal with you know. So it's like this is like a thing that's just like in the air, and I think we're just like thinking about it a lot.
Well, I think that there's kind of a lot of stuff in the air right now. You know, you touched on some of it, and one of the things that seems to be like definitely in the air is just, I mean, women's stories are selling now, like in a way that I don't know, maybe they probably never had the opportunity to before. They probably would have sold if they had been out there in the, mm-hmm, world. But I feel like there's suddenly a lot more space. I'm not sure if that's the right way to look at it, though. But I feel like there's so many more women authors from all kinds of backgrounds who are like getting a lot of attention and who are kind of becoming, well, like the new vanguard or whatever, right? Like there's like, there's sort of an appetite for that and more of a, I don't know, there's an appetite for it, which maybe was always there, but there's like maybe more of a willingness to publish it or more of a willingness to promote it.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's sort of actually a bunch of different things. Like, I mean, on one hand, not to be cynical, but like feminism is a brand that sells. Like there is a sort of level of like, this is a thing that is acceptable for like companies to make money on you know, and like, so the reason, for example, that we're seeing like so many like gay, we're seeing more like gay stories and more feminist stories is because right now we're in, we're in a place where that sort of thing is permissible and is even like profitable. But I don't think that necessarily means that like it, I don't know if that's as much as changing. It's just like technology is permitting this. Certain sort of independent groups, but there's like just sort of weird little pockets that like are permitting it. And so it is like happening, but I don't necessarily know if that means that like it's different now, everything's better. Like, I don't actually know if that's the case. I'm also very cynical about all this.
And I wonder, right. Like, I wonder if there's a moment where people are like, ooh, we can, if we buy this book, right. Like if we buy this author's work, we think that's going to sell because it's going to fit into this like group of like
totally
women of color writers who've sold well in previous years. And that's a moment that may not be a change that lasts.
Right. The problem is that we think I just mean like culture. We think of like minority, the art of non-dominant groups can be trendy, but we think of like men and whiteness and straightness as like eternal and not trendy, and just like that is the natural baseline, and anything else is like a trend. So like publishing and other sort of art forms might follow those trends, but like ultimately we'll always return to this like baseline. And of course that's fake, right? Like that's not real. Men and white and straight and cis and all those things are not like are not neutral, but we think of them as neutral. So I feel like we're in this place where like, you know, there are these like spikes, but it's because of this trendiness but that doesn't mean that that's going to be that way forever. Right. So until we like reconceive of like what is neutral, like what is the center? And if we keep thinking of like maleness and whiteness, et cetera, as to the center, then we're going to keep like cycling back to that, you know? And so I think there's like a different way to conceive of it that is like, but again, that's about divesting. That's about like rejecting the structure altogether of everything, which is like really different than just being like rah rah, like yay. Like it's actually more about like pulling everything out from the roots and like starting again. And how do we do that? And I don't know. Like I don't know how we do that. I think that's like a big question. And I think, you know, we'll see.
Yeah. If the question is basically like, okay, well, if we need to redefine what neutral is, or like sort of what normal is, and we cannot do that unless we can deal with our own internalized misogyny, right? And so it's like, okay, well, then how do we deal with that? And that's such a huge question. Right. Then you know, it's like, it's a long haul to get back around to like, okay, then what does the world look like after that? And like, who the hell knows?
Right.
But I'm curious, what has that meant in your personal work in your life? So like, how did you get to a place where you felt like you had the confidence to show up with, you know, I'll use your quote from earlier, your like with your fat mind and to say like, I'm here and I'm going to take up space and I'm going to tell the stories that I want to tell. And I'm going to do them in these genres that haven't really been recognized, or I'm going to take genre and I'm going to do whatever the fuck I want with it. Like, how did you get to a place where you felt like that was something you could do?
I wish I could say that it was all internal, because certainly part of the process is like being like, I'm going to do this thing. Part of it was actually, but part, a lot of it was other people. You know, I was lucky in that, like, I had, like, my girlfriend / wife, who's, like, brilliant and I trust and love, like, being like, this is really awesome. This is really different. There were other people in my life, like, really encouraging me and, like, you know, readers who read my work and wrote to me. And, you know, so there were, like, these other sort of forces working. And then at some point, I feel like I was looking at what I was doing and I was like, I have something to say. And, you know, the interesting thing about being like a writer or being any kind of artist is like, you have to have an ego, because, you know, you have to say like, what I'm creating is important enough that I think other people should like pay for it, should read it, you know, it should be published or it should be presented or whatever. And like, that requires an amount of ego where you're like, I think that what I have to say is that important. And I think sometimes people forget that element of it, or they're like, oh, like this person's so arrogant or whatever. But it's like, no, you have to believe that, or else why the fuck are you writing? What's the point? Or why are you making whatever art? So at some point I had to be like, yes, like I'm really good at this and I'm gonna do it. And I'm just gonna make this happen. And that felt really amazing and it felt really, and it felt right. And now, so it's like I had to get over this hump. And then at some point, like, obviously, like, the book started doing really well. And I was like, okay, so I wasn't. But even if the book hadn't done well, I think I still would have felt that way. Like, I'm good at what I do. Like, I know that I'm good at. I'm not good at a lot of things. Like, you know, I can't draw to save my life. Like, you know, I'm really bad at dancing. Like, I am not a fast runner. When I paint walls, it's always really crooked. Like, there I do not have a lot of skills, but I know that I'm a good writer. And that I can say that. And like, I know that's true. And I would never, you know, I don't ever say things like I would never claim to be like anything that I'm not. And like, but I know I'm a good writer and I have that, they have that. And so I can sort of move forward with that. And that's like in my arsenal of like getting through my life and like getting through everything and knowing that and believing that. So yeah, I don't know. So I think it is like, it's partially like sort of taking from other people what they are handing to you. Cause I think also sometimes people will say to you like, you're really good at this thing. And you want to be like, especially women want to be like, no. Like I'm not. Oh, you know, like I thank you. Like I'm just doing what I do, you know? And it's like, you want it because you're trained to like minimize yourself in that way. And it's like saying, oh, thank you. I worked really hard on that. So thanks so much. Like, I really appreciate it. And it can be scary. And also I feel like sometimes for me, like I get really scared when I have to admit, like for example, like right now I'm working on this new book and like, I'm really scared that I'm not smart enough to write it. And that's a really scary to admit. Because it's like, oh my God, like, what if I've bitten off more than I can chew? Like, what, you know? And so now I've got to like rapidly make myself the kind of writer who can get through this project. And that's like a very terrifying challenge. But also that's how I know I'm getting better because I'm like pushing myself through like these new stages of art. And if, you know, when I read my book came out in October. When I read it, I'm like, I'm already a better writer than I was when I wrote this book. And that's really exciting too, being like, oh no, like I, you know, I'm already better. Like, I'm already sick of reading from it because I'm like, oh, I can do better than this, you know? So, yes, I feel like it's like taking what people give you, sort of, you know, challenging yourself and pushing yourself and, you know, knowing what you're good at. And I think also like a lot of that involves like being bad at things. Like, I don't know, my dad is a chemical engineer. And the poor man was trying to get me to be a scientist for like my entire life. And of course, I like at every turn just resisted him in every way. Because I'm bad. I'm not good at math. I'm not good at, you know, like I'm not good at any of that stuff. But I do remember like getting, I think a C in chemistry in high school. And I had like a conniption. Like I was having like a nervous breakdown. And my dad was like, look, he said, did you do your best? And I said, I did. Like, I was like going for school. I was like, we're studying for the test. He's like, that's all you can do. It's okay. You're not good at, no one's good at everything. He's like, I never trust people who have like straight A's in absolutely everything. Cause it's like, you gotta fail. He didn't say fuck up, but I said, you gotta fuck up sometimes. You gotta be like, I'm gonna try this thing. Maybe I'll get a little better. Maybe not. Like, but also I can do this, or this thing gives me pleasure. And I'm gonna do it anyway. And I feel like there's this way of just like figuring out like, like how you occupy your space and like being okay with being bad at things and also being comfortable with being good at something. And men are good at both of those things. Men are really good at being like super confident in everything that they're doing. And it's like also fucking up royally at the same time.
It is going on.
Right. And like women are just like, and I feel like it's like, cause we're just taught to do that. We're taught to like agonize. Freak out and agonize at every turn. And it's like, you don't have to live your life that way. That's like a prison. That's fake. So yeah. So I don't know. And this is all stuff that I've only realized in the last like few years of my life, you know? And so there's something really like freeing about that.
I love it so much.
I'm so glad.
I love it so much because, you know, we talk about this a lot on the show, the sort of like having other, like when other people come to you and tell you you're doing great and like how important it is to actually listen to them and take that seriously. Cause it's so easy to brush it off. And again, like to come back to what I mentioned at the beginning, like to reduce your own successes to luck, yeah. Right? Yeah. And to like, oh yeah, I mean, it's not to say like there are some ways in which we all get lucky. There are ways in which we happen to have this moment and the right thing at the right time. But like, things have happened for me in ways that were good because I worked my ass off, yeah, right? Like I'm right. Good at things and that is why I've gotten a lot.
And I think also recognizing, because for me, like people will ask me like, what is this? You're having this moment. What does that mean? And I'm like, well, like it's a lot of things. Like it is some amount of luck. Like there's timing. Timing is a thing you often can't predict, but like good timing. Yes, I've worked my ass off. I'm also really privileged in a lot of ways. Like I grew up, you know, I was educated. Like I grew up in a certain kind of household. Like I've never like been hungry. I've never like been homeless. Like there's like all these things sort of working for me. So it's like, you know, and also, yeah, I'm working really hard. And also I have some talent. And I think there's like saying like, I have a talent, which is a thing that, like, is sort of nebulous and is hard to pin down. And, like, where does it come from? And can you teach it? And, like, I mean, that's kind of beyond this purview. And I could talk about that for, like, 10 hours. But there's, like, that element. There's privilege, which you can't control. There's luck, which you also can't control. All you can control is, like, the hard work element.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you can teach this necessarily, but it seems like something you can give to someone.
Or, like, right? Or, like, let someone know about it. Yeah, no, for sure.
Talk about more. Yeah. Like you're saying. I mean, yeah. I think talking to each other and talking to other women who may not, just may not, have experience talking about this stuff or listening to people who have experienced it. It's, you know.
Or also, like, sort of been taught to be ashamed of it. Like, something we talk about a lot is how common it is for women to feel like they shouldn't talk about their ambitions or talk about things they want or, like, or to, like, to be able to say out loud, like, the intentionality that they have or they put into things. And
it's very gauche to be like, this is what I want or this is my goal.
And I'm kind of fucking tired of that. Yeah. Like, I'm not interested in that. I want to hear what women want and like what they're doing.
But now, like, in a Mel Gibson kind of way.
Never. Carmen, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Oh, of course. No problem. Thank you.
Is everybody ready for the fuck yeah of the week?
I'm so ready.
I am always ready for the fuck yeah this week because the fuck yeah this week, naps.
How do you feel right now just saying the word naps?
I feel like I want a nap.
You know what thinking about napping does? It can reduce your blood pressure.
Just thinking about it?
Just thinking about a nap. There was a recent study that found that just people anticipating naps was enough to lower your blood pressure.
So we should be thinking more about snoozing.
Maybe this is why my blood pressure is so great, because I think about naps a lot.
Everyone just stop for a second. Think about a nap.
So I don't nap like all people nap. Like, some people are like, oh my gosh, if I sit down for a nap, it's like 2 hours. And I'm like, I don't have that kind of time. But when I take a nap, I take a micro nap. And
what is a micro nap? And tell me more.
Okay. So, you know, I work at home. And, you know, sometimes you get that, like, afternoon lull where your brain doesn't work that well. It's like after lunch and you just need a minute. If I have a little bit of time, something that I'll often do is I will set my alarm for 12 or 15 minutes and I'll just kind of doze off. And when I wake back up 12 to 15 minutes later, I feel so much better. And I know it sounds wild, right? Like, I know it sounds wild to be like, wait, you nap for 12 minutes?
Stop. Does this work? Is this real?
So it works for me. And I'll tell you when it works. It works when I'm having an afternoon where I get that sluggish, tired feeling and where I'm feeling so sleepy already that I'm like, I just can't. So I'm already like pretty sleepy feeling. And I figure, like, instead of trying to fight it, I just lean into it and then come back, bounced back. And so for me, when I'm in that zone, I've found that that kind of little break is much more productive than like trying to fight through it. So here's my 12 minute story. Okay. 2 minutes to fall asleep, 10 minutes of napping.
And you fall asleep within those 2 minutes?
Oftentimes I can fall into like a light sleep.
I feel like my blood pressure's dropped just listening to you tell the story.
I have not usually been able to do that. And I think now I'm listening to you say this and I'm wondering if it's something I could maybe just like try to practice a little bit more, because when I have napped and just like been able to do it for half an hour or something, even that is, you know, really nice and I feel refreshed. But I feel like I was always one of those people who I would go to sleep to nap, and I would 2 hours later I'd wake up and I'd be like, ah, everything's shot. And then you feel terrible.
Yeah, I mean, I can't do that. If I lie down for that long, it's like you're just brain foggy because you go into those deep sleep cycles. I don't do that. It's just like a real quick thing. And here's the thing. You know, my number one tip for getting good at the micro nap. I mean, I don't know if micro naps are going to work for you or not. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. But my tip is, like, first up, learn to feel really good about the idea. Like, don't feel bad or guilty about taking a little nap. Don't feel like you should be doing something else. Don't feel like it's sort of like indulgent. Feel like sometimes that is the most productive way that you could be spending your time.
There's so many studies about how good naps are for you. I mean, like things like just being more alert, increasing your patience, reducing heart disease.
oh my God, I need way more patience. So should I take a lot more naps?
We need to up it to 17.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, the other thing I think, though, like you were saying, Cattell, like you need to practice a little bit. I do think it's the kind of thing, like, even if you've mentally given yourself permission, you may not have, like, kind of physically, like really let go of this idea that taking a nap is like a weird thing to be doing. So like normalize it and then it might get easier to fall asleep.
Completely. I think that is absolutely true. And I think also just doing some sort of physical hygiene around that where, you know, I'm putting myself in like a very comfortable place and making it conducive to doing that instead of being like, I'm sitting on the couch already. I'm just going to like lay my head down. That doesn't always work.
One of the things that always frustrated me as a new mom is everyone was like, sleep when baby sleeps. And I'm like, but I can't just sleep on demand. And that would be so annoying because you can't predict the sleep schedule of your newborn or toddler, it turns out. And so he would go to sleep and I'd be like, well, I want to sleep, but I wouldn't be able to fall asleep. And so like, and I would give myself 2 minutes, 10 minutes, 15, and I wouldn't fall asleep. And then I would just get frustrated and think about that. And then I would just give up and do something else like eat or shower, which was fine, other necessities. But I then eventually realized that for me, it wasn't just about falling asleep. The idea of just lying down and giving my body and sometimes my mind a chance to just relax also was really refreshing. So I've gotten way better at that. So maybe not falling asleep, but this idea of just breaks and resting and giving myself a chance to do that. And like you were saying, Sarah, being okay with that and also being okay if I don't fall asleep. And I think that was one of the things that was one of my biggest battles, that I'd be like, napping's not working. I'm not falling asleep, but being like, you know what? I'm just going to lie here for 10 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour, whenever he decides to wake back up. And I'm just going to be.
Did you ever think that you would be just like looking forward to when he's like a surly tween or teen and like won't get up until 11:30? So yeah, naps. I recommend it. They are Sarah approved. I think you should take them. I think you should feel good about them. I recognize if you work like in a traditional office, you may not be able to do what I do in the middle of the day as easily. And that's okay. But I do think giving yourself those little breaks and like letting yourself try to relax, it's like, I had to get over the feeling of like I was wasting time and to think like, man, I'm actually saving time because I'm not going to be productive for the next like 90 minutes if I try to push through this tired period.
That reset button is so important. Fuck yeah, naps.
Fuck yeah.
I'm going to go take a nap now.
That's it for this week's episode of Know You Go, the show about being ambitious and sticking together and naps. NYG is recorded in our home city of Philadelphia and produced by Seth Colburn. Our theme music is by The Diaphone. Thanks to Carmen Maria Machado for being our guest today. If you like what you've been hearing, please make sure to subscribe and rate us on your podcast provider. Your support helps us spread the word. We'll be back again next week.